This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Picture it, Lawson. Your face is so, you're so cheerful. Picture it, Los Angeles, 2024.
You can only see my face if you are part of our Patreon. I'm so cheerful. Don't expect me to smile that much more. Welcome to Out on the Lanai, the only Golden Girls podcast you're ever going to need to listen to. I am H. Allen Scott / Sati Pines. That's P-I-N-E-S. Thank you.
Oh, every week it's different. I'm here for it. I'm Carrie Doherty. Today we're doing another Golden Rewind where we go back and rewatch our favorite episodes of The Golden Girls and offer new insights since we first started breaking down these episodes way back in 2014. And get those stamps out because today we're writing letters to Marilyn Prison. We just rewatched season 5, episode 13, Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Oh, why we chose this episode? You might be asking yourself, why? This is so random. Is this one of the episodes we skip over? No, it is not one of the episodes we skip over. Well, the reason, though, why we chose this episode is because we are speaking with Mary herself, Julie McCullough. Yes. Oh my God. Yes. We got married. That sounds like we got married. We didn't get married to Mary, but we do love Julie McCullough so, so much. So this is how it's going to work. We're going to do the recap like we always do. And then at the end of this episode, right before our golden takeaways, we're going to tease a little bit of our interview right at the very, very end with Julie. You're going to love it. If you want the full interview, you can sign up for our GG VIP club at the $8 a month level, the Miami Museum Program Coordinator tier. And if you're in the $5 a month tier, you can always upgrade to the $8 tier, even just for this month, if you want to just see this chat with Julie, because it was so much fun.
It was so much fun. And I hope you'll also enjoy just the little snippet that we're going to play in this episode. She had so much to talk about. I feel like
so many stories.
Of all of our guests so far in terms of like, oh, what do you remember from your time on the show, like with guest stars? She has remembered the most. She has a wild story about one of the women saving her from getting fired on her first day. She tells this story about how she was hired on the show during a very controversial time in her career. Bea Arthur gave her advice about this controversy while they were shooting that scene in the bedroom when she has the Walkman on. And
it's going to make you love Bea Arthur so much more than you already do.
Love, and you're going to be like, oh my God. Yeah, that's right, Bea.
Oh, my God.
And then she sort of talks about, you know, what it's like being now a golden girl herself, being of a certain age. And I'm obsessed with Julie. She was so cool.
She was so cool. You know what I love about our chat with Julie? I love speaking with stand-up comics, and she is a stand-up comic. And she was even doing some stand-up comedy back when she was doing this episode of The Golden Girls. And I just love talking to comics. There's just sort of there's a rhythm that comics have when you chat that I find so enjoyable. But one thing that I love about her is that this period in her life was so interesting, and her being cast on The Golden Girls after some of the drama, and we'll explain it more during our chat with Julie, but it was she was on Growing Pains, Kirk Cameron is an asshole. You can listen to me hate on him a lot on that during our chat with Julie McCullough. But there was a lot of drama around that moment. And the very fact that she even got cast on the Golden Girls says something about the production of the Golden Girls, because she had been, she was a pariah in sort of Hollywood in a lot of ways, in her certain circle of Hollywood, and unintentionally a pariah. I mean, she did nothing to make herself a pariah.
It was all society doing it. That's it. She was in Playboy.
And it wasn't like she had posed that month. She was in Playboy years before all of this had gone down. So it was a really, really, really interesting chat. And what I think you're going to take away from it is how much you're going to love the production of the Golden Girls even more for even keeping her in this episode and having her be in this episode. It really says something about the girls, and it says something about the show and how she was treated by the girls, but also the production just even taking a chance on her and letting her be in this episode while she was in the National Enquirer every fucking week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everything, her perspective on life, her, you know, the fact that she was a huge fan of the Golden Girls when she was cast, and she loved Maude. She was obsessed with Bea Arthur because, you know, this wasn't the fifth season. The show is already doing really well. Just all of that. And then learning that almost as like, I don't want to say like a slight to Kirk Cameron, maybe a little bit, but like she's in a lot of like Christian movies these days, but she's like only ones that have like good messages. But I love that Kirk Cameron got her essentially got her fired off of Growing Pains. And she just turned around. She's like, well, I'm going to be in Christian movies too. My Playboy ass is going to be in Christian movies. I love that about her. Yeah.
What I love about her, and she talks about being a Christian herself and about, you know, sort of why she does these movies, but she talks about being a Christian that's focused on the love part of Christianity, the acceptance part of Christianity, the be there for your fellow person sort of part of Christianity. And she puts a focus on that. And I think that's so admirable. And it's sort of the opposite of what Kirk Cameron does to this day, which is his version. I mean, I'm just going to say it because I'm very open about how much I hate Kirk Cameron, but his Christianity is about isolation and separation and judgment and damning and segregation and so many different things that I can't support it. And so I love that she is doing what she's doing. But not only is she doing what she's doing, she's not doing it in a spiteful way. She's doing it in a very sort of inclusive, loving, like, this is where my life is, and I'm super happy, and I'm telling jokes, and I'm acting, and I'm living, and I'm bringing people into my home who need a home, and I'm helping people, and I'm giving back to my fellow artists. And it's just such like a what you hope people to be. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she is that.
She is that. Yeah. I don't want to tip too much of the interview because, I mean, we had a nice long chat with her. I want everybody to be able to listen to it. But I do, before we take a break, just want to talk a little bit about the importance of this episode and Julie's storyline is Mary, because I think, you know, when we think about like the sort of big kind of progressive topic episodes that the Golden Girls did, you know, we think of 72 Hours, we think of Clayton and Gay Marriage, but this one was about teen pregnancy. And when you think about it, none of the women judged or shamed her.
Not once.
And I loved that. And like I said, this doesn't really stick out as like sort of one of the like very special episodes of the Golden Girls. But when we watched it, I was like, oh yeah, this was a very special episode.
But it doesn't feel like it. It does not feel like a very special episode at all.
No, the way they handled it was so great. And another thing that I think comes across in the writing and the acting in this episode, Mary's obviously only in this episode, but her chemistry with the women and the way that she's sort of written, it really did feel like she's known these women for years.
And that's a testament to Julie as an actress. Really, it is.
It was like, you know, because Dorothy was a really great mentor for her in this episode because she also got pregnant in high school. What a smart and thoughtful way to convey Dorothy's own past through this episode, because Dorothy kind of had to relive that. you know, her own teen mm-hmm. pregnancy and what her father thought about all of it. And one more thing I do want to say, and I know we have a lot, so maybe we'll take a break, but the thing that I thought was interesting about this episode is Mary is the one with the problem in the episode. Normally on the Golden Girls, one of the main characters, one of the girls, they're the ones with the problem. But Mary really mm-hmm. is the one with the problem in this episode. And then the women just sort of spend the majority of the time talking about it and kind of dealing with it mm-hmm. because they're the adults and she's the kid. So even though she yep. has the problem, well, they're the adults. So they're going to mm-hmm. really be the ones to deal with it. I was like, man, yeah. I feel like I've really overlooked this episode in the past. And
it's not one that I skip. I think I do have it on, but it is, I do find a lot of times I skip the guest star episodes just because if they are guest star heavy, sometimes I'm like, I want the girls. I just want the girls. Come on now. And this episode has three guest stars and active guest stars with like lots of lines. And I mean, Meryl being one of those three. So, and the dog, you could include the dog too, because we'll get to it, but the dog, if you've seen Anatomy of a Fall, that movie that's up for Best Picture, I mean, the Oscars have already happened at this point, but there's a dog in that movie that's like an incredible actor dog, like genius. I think the dog in this episode is comparable to the dog in Anatomy of a Fall.
The dog did a lot of great work. And you're right. It is guest star heavy. And also these two stories, normally there's like a bigger A story and a smaller B story. I will say Mary and Meryl, these two stories had equal weight with mm-hmm. Mary, Meryl, Mary, mm-hmm. Meryl, Mary, Harry. You know, they had equal weight. I mean, I don't know if we're ready to take a break. Should we just kind of dive in and then take a break?
Yes,
shortly?
We're ready to take a break.
We are ready. Let's do it. Let's take a break and then we'll dive in.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
And we are back talking about Mary Had a Little Lamb. Because both of these stories have equal weight and because we want to leave some room at the end of the episode for our chat with Julie, we're going to talk about the Meryl story first, and then we're going to get into the Mary story. I can't believe they had two guest stars with Mary Meryl, with just such similar names.
Yeah.
Okay. So Blanche has a prison pen pal named Meryl. She writes sexy letters to him. How do you think this started?
Well, I mean, I have to admit, I've often thought it. There's an Instagram account. I have to find it. I don't know. But a lot of times on Reels, it'll like pop up or whatever. But there's this one prison in like Idaho or something. I don't know where the prison is, but they let the men record videos of like, hey, I'm in here doing time for like another 5 years. I would really love a friend. So my number is 785-723. You can find me on the web portal or whatever. And you can email with these dudes in prison. And of course, I don't do it. But I often think like this reel has gotten hundreds of thousands of views. So theoretically, that person is probably getting at least 20 or 30 emails from random people. You know what I mean? Like a small portion, I'm sure, but still he's getting messages. So I think I might be, if I was lonely and bored one night, I think I might. It's a new way of aiming.
Like, how do you think she found Meryl?
Well, I think it was, I don't know actually, because like back in the day, I don't know if it was like, did the church have a program
or was it like through the classifieds?
Blanche ain't going to no church. Blanche is not going to church. No, I wonder. I wonder. Oh, God. Do you know how many times I have, like, I wrote a letter once to one of the Menendez brothers, just cause. And yeah, I mean, I've written some letters to prisoners before, oftentimes work-related situations. Sure. But you know, I'm not opposed to it. So maybe she just sort of was like, I want to do my service and have it. Maybe there was a pen pal program similar to what the Instagram is now, because that's essentially a pen pal program. So maybe that is what it was. There was like a pen pal program where they have a listing of a thing and you could like, it's like a Dear Abby maybe situation where the prisoner is sort of like, hey, I'm Meryl and I'm looking for a friend. Write me.
Sure. Yeah. Like, maybe that's what it was. You know? Yeah. That seems the most likely. Well, I do want to play a little moment of what these letters sound like because they are filthy.
Filthy.
Oh, it's no problem, honey. It's just another one of those letters from Meryl. I would read it to you anyway. They're not personal.
Not personal? The man said he wants to lie naked with you on a beach.
Sure, and I wrote him I want to make passionate love to him in a hammock suspended between two magnolia trees. You know, that couldn't possibly happen.
Well, maybe if you lose a few pounds.
I love that Rose joke. It's so funny. So
I do too.
We learn that Meryl is doing, I think, 20 years for armed robbery.
That seems like a long time for armed robbery.
For armed robbery?
I mean, but how else are you going to rob? You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, you know, what? You're going to just rob? Like, if you just go in and be like, hey, give me your money with, like, your hands up. Like, all robbery is armed. So it shouldn't add more years just because it's armed.
I don't think all robbery is armed.
I mean, yes, you could steal people's money in like a fraud scheme. That's robbery, I guess. But like robbery is like you walk into the gas station and you say, give me all your money. And you have to do that with a weapon of some kind.
Yeah. Or if you put your finger in your shirt or something. I don't know. I feel like it doesn't matter because he gets out on a technicality. But yeah. Dorothy has an interesting opinion about these letters. She doesn't think it's really nice to lead him on.
I agree.
Blanche, yeah, it's like they know what this is. And, you know, Blanche thinks it's harmless until, of course, she realizes she misread his latest letter and realizes he's getting out a little bit sooner than she realized. Her silk flower robe in the scene when she's talking to Rose, the red, the black, the yellow, the white. I don't think she wore it too much on this show that I can recall, but
I was noticing that too. And I liked it. I like all of Blanche's clothes and I liked the flow of it, but it did look a little bit like a curtain to me.
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was gorgeous. Well, I do want to play the moment where Blanche discovers that Meryl's getting out.
Rose. Oh, Rose.
Blanche, what's wrong?
I never finished reading this letter from Meryl till just now. Read that last paragraph.
My sentence has been overturned on a technicality. I'm getting out on the 21st. Now, finally, we can make all our dreams come true.
Isn't that terrible?
Well, he's written catchier stuff, but I wouldn't call it terrible.
For a literary critique, you dweeb.
Sophia also has a really great line at the end of the scene. She's like, oh, that's rough. After 20 years in the jug, he's going to be pretty short on foreplay.
I mean, I would. But also, the ultimate outcome of this is that Meryl isn't who they're presenting themselves to be. And of course, someone else wrote the letters for Meryl. Like, we learn all of this later. And I mean, I'm surprised no one else thought that. Like, I'm surprised no one thought about, like, hey, what if he's having someone else write his letters for him? Or what if he's, like, just copying letters from a poetry book or something? Because that's actually genius.
I don't think any of it matters because when we meet Meryl, it is very clear that despite anything that he wrote, he is not a good person. He is someone for women to be scared of.
Well,
like when Sophia's running around hiding the valuables, I'm like, yeah, you've got the right idea. Dorothy is so naive in this moment. She's like,
So
she's
naive.
Like, he's harmless. She's like, he's harmless because his letters are poetic. I'm like, what are you talking about? I mean, everybody said Ted Bundy was charming. Like, no.
He was, though.
No. And I do want to play the moment that we meet Meryl, because I have so much to say about this guy's performance.
I have a lot to say about him as well.
I cannot believe that Meryl is a dangerous criminal. I mean, you've read his letters. They're beautiful. They're poetic. They're almost lyrical. You can be sure he's a real gentleman.
I want Blanche.
Perfect delivery. No notes. I'm telling you.
Yeah, no notes.
This guy was cast 3 seconds into his audition because, like, think about how many different deliveries every other actor gave for the words, I want Blanche. There's a guy that's like, I want Blanche.
Wait, I have a question. So this is sort of like a Hilary Swank office situation. Do you think Meryl is hot?
No.
No? Why?
I don't know. I think the actor was so good in his performance that he made me feel uncomfortable.
Well, see, here's the thing. The hot factor, the hotness factor of him does not stem from his appearance, which is why I think it's the Hilary Swank connection. It's not his appearance that makes him hot. It's his performance that makes him hot. It's a James Gandolfini soprano situation here, where James Gandolfini, God rest his soul, was not hot. However, James Gandolfini as Tony Soprano in Emmy Award-winning Sopranos is hot. So to me, Meryl, the performance, is hot because it's dangerous.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, I get that. I can understand that.
I'm dying for people to chime in the comments and replies and DMs about this. I need to know, is Meryl hot? Sound off now.
He doesn't look like a Meryl. That's for sure.
He doesn't look like a Meryl, although he does look like a, because you know how Southerners kind of have, like, I'm just going to say it, faggy names sometimes. Like, they just have like, especially the men, like, sometimes, like, they're unintentionally faggy because of their names or nicknames or whatever. And so Meryl could potentially be one of those Southern faggy names that, like, they're not gay, but yet because of their name. The only time it ever really lined up perfectly was Leslie Jordan. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like Leslie Jordan was really gay, but also you could have another Leslie Jordan out there who's just this like butch carpenter dude from South Carolina. But his mom was like, well, I had to name him after my Aunt Leslie because we loved Aunt Leslie.
Right.
And it's like, poor Leslie. He's just trying to cut wood.
Can't wait to pull that moment and put it on Instagram. There is something about the way that Meryl sits and the way that he doesn't sit still and the way that he fidgets. That's why his performance was so good. It made you horny. It made me uneasy.
Yes, yeah. It did.
So he just lets himself into the house. I love how Dorothy and Sophia huddle together so closely and just squeeze into the chair together. It reminded me of, like, in The Break-In when all of the women are... Wait, you've got a wild look on your face right now. What's happening?
I'm just thinking of a joke. Okay. Continue.
Okay. You're making yourself laugh. I love this. So, but a moment, they're huddled together on the chair, but then a moment later, Dorothy gets up and sits on the couch right next to him. And I know it was for the moose joke, but I was just like, ah, Dorothy, what are you doing? You're clearly like creeped out by this guy. Then you just go and you sit next to him.
Maybe she's like me and has like a secret attraction.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And when Blanche and Rose come home and, you know, Blanche is kind of like, ooh, who's your friend, Dorothy? And she was like, this is Meryl.
But I mean, the delusion of Blanche, that's what's so funny. Like, if I walked in to my home and I saw that man sitting on my couch, My first reaction would not necessarily be, oh, he looks charming. Let me get him a cup of tea.
Well, you just said he was hot.
Well, no, but he's hot because of his, like, personality. He's not physically hot. That's what I was
saying. You don't think he was conveying that when Blanche walked in?
No, he was not conveying hot when Blanche walked in. He was only hot in the, I want Blanche.
I want Blanche.
Yeah, no, that is hot. But the sitting on the couch, just sitting on the couch, no. So, like, how Blanche does... But also, they've only been talking about this prisoner getting out of jail for, like, the last day or so. So, clearly, if there's a strange man wearing all denim on your couch, likely option is that this is Meryl, Blanche.
I mean, their feelings and thoughts about Meryl, they flip-flop a lot. I had issues with mm-hmm. that. But I will say... that moment when she does come home, her sitting and then very quickly jumping up off of the couch, the physical mm-hmm. acting from Rue McClanahan was so great. It was giving me like shrimp yeah. vibes where you're just like, how does someone just make that choice as an actor? It's so brilliant. So everybody pretends that Blanche isn't Blanche. And then Blanche decides she's going to go stay with her friend Janet, which it's funny because she also has a daughter named Janet. And she does have a great joke. She's like, she said I could spend the night anytime. Or was it her husband, Ed, who said that? I love that joke. But I don't know why Blanche is leaving, because Meryl doesn't think Blanche is Blanche. So the yeah. other women are in no less danger than Blanche. And I don't know why why aren't all the women leaving? Why aren't they more worried about Meryl, who literally said he'd be yeah. coming back? And now they have a 16-year-old girl in their house. Every yeah. woman should be leaving knowing Meryl is coming back. I don't know why it's just Blanche who's leaving. He doesn't think Blanche is Blanche.
Oh, that's so funny. You're right. Oh, my God. They have a child in
the home. They have a child in their home.
They have a child. I didn't ever even put that together.
And talk about like the flip-flopping. Wow. So Blanche doesn't even make it to Janet's house when she turns around and she comes home and she's like, oh, I was being silly. The man paid his debt to society. I'm sure he's harmless. And it's like, no, Blanche, he didn't. He literally got out on yeah. a technicality. He didn't fully pay his debt. It's not like he was paroled. He has been scary this whole time, everyone. We don't need to not sit next to him, then sit next to him. Like, stop giving him the B of the doubt. Stop yeah. giving it to yeah. him. And then he ties up Sophia, which is frightening. And the women don't even call the police.
I know. That's the crazy thing, too. I mean, it would have added a lot to this story. Like, that's just a creative thing. But like, still, like,
I think at the top of that scene, when Blanche gets the call that she's like, you know, he's back in prison or whatever, they could have made some kind of comment about that they were the ones who called, but they didn't seem to. I don't know. They didn't infer that.
Yeah.
I also couldn't believe, because he stole Blanche's silver and jewels. I mean, remember in the break-in episode, she gets so mad that her mama's jewels are stolen. She's like, we are going to find the burglars and kill them. But when...
Yeah, but her parents are all dead now. She's sort of like, whatever, let's move on.
I don't know. When Meryl calls, she doesn't even ask, like, where are my things? She's just like, yeah. What am I wearing? Well, I'm wearing it. It's like Blanche. Blanche Devereaux.
It's so good. Oh. I love it. It's so problematic, too. I love it.
Like, women just. Men are dangerous and scary sometimes.
Well, men, so, I mean, let's not generalize here. I was going to even say, don't generalize all men in prison.
No, I said however, men are dangerous sometimes. This man was a walking red flag.
Yes, this man, while hot, was definitely a situation that you probably should not engage in. He's a one and go person. You know what I mean? Like, you have your fun, you push him away, you lock the door, you change the locks. Like, you get a new cell phone. You give him a Google phone number. Like, that's the kind of guy this guy is.
Yeah. Yeah. Or wait for him to trespass onto your property and then get him thrown back in.
Or literally, I mean, he just, he broke whatever probably jail release situation he has by stealing her stuff. So like, get him back in prison, y'all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. He was a very violating person. So that's, yes, that's the Meryl story. And yeah, on to the Mary story.
Well, let's take a break before we get to the Mary story, actually. Yes.
And we are back talking about our Mary story in Mary Had a Little Lamb. Mm. I love that Sophia knows that Mary is pregnant just by looking at her.
I know. Do you think that's real, though? Some people swear by it. Some people say that they can tell when someone's pregnant by, like little things about themselves.
Well, I mean, first, we know that Sophia knew Jean was a lesbian before Jean even knew. I think mm-hmm. a mother just knows, but she says the reason she knows is because the panicked look on Mary's face is the same as when Dorothy was pregnant as a teenager. So I think that's how she knows. I mean, I think Sophia also likes to pretend she knows, like when she's like, the man's as gay as a picnic basket, but that's because she heard him singing in the shower.
Yeah.
So Rose and Sophia. Sophia is really the only one. Again, none of these women ever shame Mary, which I really like.
Which I love. I love.
Sophia makes a lot of slut jokes that, you know, but it's Sophia. She has no filter. So I just go, okay.
But there's also nothing wrong with being a slut.
That is also true. So Rose has a line. She's like, I can't believe it. It seems like only yesterday you were selling us cookies. Sophia's like, now she's giving them away. And Mary is, I mean, overwhelmed and stressed out because her dad kicked her out. The baby's father mm-hmm. went away to college.
In one of those crushing scenes when the boyfriend kicked her out.
What was she to do? Where was she to go? She was out on her fanny.
She was out on her fanny. Over to the Sheffield's
door. Over the bridge to the Sheffield's door. No. Everybody's like, shut up to both of you. Shut up.
No, they're definitely, I guarantee you, there are many listeners who are like, do the nanny next.
I know. Well, we still have a lot of these women's lives to follow in this podcast. So yeah, Mary's stressed. She needs a place to stay. She's like, I got to get a job. And, you know, the women are just like, stay with us until you figure it out. And it's so, so sweet. And
it's like what you would want. It's what you would want any parent, you know, you would have like the faith that your parent wouldn't kick you out in that moment. You know what I mean? Like you'd want to know that like, oh, okay, I'm safe. I'm secure here. I'm okay.
Yes. Yes. You would want to feel safe and you would want to feel supported and not judged mm-hmm. and that you, you know, have someone who's going to get through this with you. That's what you hope for. But that's not what Mary got with her dad. Not at first. I do want to play some of Julie's performance as Mary because, I mean, at the time, I think she was like 24, 25 when she did this, but she does such a great job coming across as a scared teenager. I thought she played this role so naturally. I don't feel like she's acting at all. She crushed this performance. So, yeah, I do want to play a little bit of it.
Seems like old times, huh?
Oh, I love this house. I love this room. I just feel so safe here. After I visit Mom in the hospital, I always was so glad to come back here. Now here I am again. Only this time I'm pregnant. It's funny, huh?
What's that, honey?
Well, it's just that I have another human being inside of me, and I've never felt more alone.
That line, that last line of hers, I have another human being inside of me, and I've never felt more alone, such a profound line and says so much about what she's going through.
I mean, yeah. And it's just such like a, it's such a nice delivery because Julie is doing that difficult balance on a sitcom. This isn't a drama. This isn't a film where you can show emotion up close. There isn't like a lot of that, but she is balancing this child adult delivery. She's a child. Dorothy walks in on her listening to a Walkman while she's in bed, just jamming out to the Walkman, having fun. And yet at the same time, this child has had to deal with her mother dying and then now her being a mother or being pregnant. And it is, it's a lot to handle. And so she, the actress, is having to handle being a child and presenting a child, but also delivering adult lines.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. And like you said, she is a child. And Dorothy even points it out, because Dorothy says to her, you know, this is the most difficult thing for a father to accept. And she's like, that I'm a woman. And Dorothy says, but you're not. You're 16. Just because the plumbing's in doesn't mean the house is ready to occupy, which, again, is a joke, but you know, sort of another profound line, just reminding everybody, just because you're pregnant doesn't suddenly make you a woman. You're still a child. You are still 16 years old. And I think it was important, too, for Mary to understand that, to, you know, just to not like put her in check, but, you know, you're a child. You still have a father that, you know, we're going to try to, you know, repair this relationship.
Yeah. And also, too, you know, that it doesn't stop this kid from being a kid, because, I mean, I don't want to get political here, but in the day and age that this episode was airing on television, women did have a right, and in all of the states across the country, and they had a right to make a decision about what to do with their body and handle their own health care. And so there were options that could have been discussed. And now we live in a very different world, where in many states you can't do that. And she doesn't have an option. And so she is a child without a choice, and a parent that has no choice. And that's a really, like, watching this episode now in light of everything that's happening with reproductive rights was really eye-opening to me, in that, you know, I think of a parent in Alabama who their 15-year-old gets pregnant, and what do you do, you know? Or even just, I mean, they're even the simple situation of IVF or whatever in certain states. So, but this storyline in particular, it was sobering to watch, because for so many women who aren't as privileged as Mary was, you know, Mary was a very privileged child. Father looked like they had a very healthy income, healthy life. She wasn't going to be destitute. She had people she could turn to, all of those things. But for so many young girls, and I say girls intentionally, they don't have that option. And so it's and in many states now, they don't have a plan B. There's no plan B that they can go to. So it was sobering to watch the storyline and sort of think about the real world implications that are happening right now.
It's also, I realize, as you mentioned that, I realize they don't actually talk about what Mary's plan is, in terms of, am I going to have an abortion? Am I going to keep this baby? Am I going to have this baby and give it up for adoption? They don't have that conversation, because the story is about what it's like to deal with it, because it was something that Dorothy had gone through, and how...
Well, I don't know if that's actually the story. And I would want to talk with someone with production in some capacity, just because there was a time, television was a lot more surprisingly liberal in the 1970s and in parts of the 1980s too. But as the 80s went on, and as, you know, commercials and advertisers and certain networks became even more powerful in certain situations, television went back to being fairly conservative in certain aspects of television. So yes, they had special episodes about gun safety or about, you know, child safety or all these different things, but there weren't that many abortion episodes happening on television in the late 1980s and early 90s. That wasn't happening. And so it started to happen again in the late 90s, but I think it was a response to Reagan America, and everyone knows how much I hate Reagan, and George H.W. Bush's presidency. And I think it had a lot to do with how conservative America was in the 80s and 90s. And so I have a feeling that there probably were discussions where the network said, no,
which is,
we're not going to
wild
do that.
Given that, you know, how many years earlier Bea Arthur did the Maud abortion episode. Yeah.
And it makes you wonder Bea Arthur's thoughts on this episode and what direction she would have hoped of this episode. And yes, there are lots of different conversations you can have about reproductive rights and about decisions that people who do get pregnant, the decisions that they can make. And it isn't that, you know, the one storyline is not just abortion. Like, that is not the only reproductive storyline that a show can do. And we should definitely say that. But that clearly is a part of the conversation when you're thinking about a situation like this. That is a part of the healthcare checklist of items that this person would have at their disposal. And so that the fact that it wasn't a part of the conversation and that it wasn't a part of the episode, to me, is suspicious, because it says that they sort of, I mean, they stripped the story down and made it more about sort of like the reactions to the right. situation and not the solutions to the situation. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. And I think, I assume that the assumption, without anybody saying it, is that Mary is going to have the baby, because at the end yeah. of the episode, you know, like Rose talks about, they were out of Lamaze classes, so I signed us up for mime classes. So I think it is interesting that the women on Richmond Street, being as sort of progressive and liberal as they are, that was never a question and for Mary in terms of like, well, what do you want to do here? I guess it was just, yeah, yeah, it's just everybody, it's a sort of unspoken assumption that she's going to have the baby and keep the baby.
And it does kind of also speak to the trajectory of Bea Arthur as a person, which we learned in our, you know, deep dive into Bea Arthur's life, that, you know, she even said herself that she didn't really necessarily think of herself as a feminist in the 1970s when she was doing Maude and some of the storylines that Maude was tackling. And she wasn't necessarily even as liberal as her character, Maude. She even said that herself. But she became more liberal and more of a feminist as she aged, as times went on. And she started to open her mind view up a little bit to other certain mm-hmm. options. And so and now at this point in Bea Arthur's career, I mean, she was obviously an animal rights activist, but all of the women were also very much involved in the AIDS activism and fundraising and charity work and all of the things. I mean, we know some of the amazing things that Estelle Getty did. And so like activism and being a part of liberal causes, which AIDS activism, reproductive rights, those were all fall under liberal causes, were a part of sort of the women's realities and what they would do. Maybe not Betty White so much, but definitely Bea Arthur and definitely Estelle Getty. And so it's interesting that it just wasn't a part of the conversation, and it makes me wonder why.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know too. It could have been a network note. There is a Blanche joke that I really love when Rose wants to sign Mary up for the natural childbirth classes. And Blanche is like, oh, she doesn't need those classes. Woman ought to have a baby the way God intended, strapped to a table and numb from the neck down. As someone who got an epidural when I had my little Oreo, it was the weirdest sensation. Like, I couldn't feel yeah. my butthole. Like, you know, when you're like, oh, tighten your butthole. Like, I could not. I hated it. Yeah. I did not like it. I did not like it. I did not like being numb.
That is something that I worried feeling. About. Well, before I go into surgery, I remember one time I was very concerned about pooping on the surgery table. Because you don't have control of, I don't believe.
No. You know, when you're pushing out a baby, you don't have control. I definitely pooped on the table when I had little Oreo.
Wow. And Stan, that's so fun.
Stan was so sweet. He wasn't going to tell me because, like, I think he thought I would be embarrassed. I figured, but you can't, it's because you can't feel anything. And also, like, I couldn't even tell yeah. if I was pushing. I was like, am I pushing? I can't tell. I can't feel anything. And then I remember my doctor, because, like, after you have a baby, they tell you, like, you can't, like, leave the hospital until you've, like, had a bowel movement. I say after I've already said the word pooped. And I remember telling my doctor, I was like, oh, I'm worried, like, I haven't gone to the bathroom or whatever. And he was like, oh, you pooped on the table. And I was like, oh, okay, great. And then Stan was like, oh, yeah, you did.
That's so funny. Yeah. I love that. So. Wow. I mean, you know, I think the sensation of not pooping and not feeling that you could feel yourself poop is something that is foreign to me. Maybe if I ate more Chipotle, I don't know. But I. I'll be here for another 20 minutes.
But people who have given birth and have had epidurals, did you also shit and not know it? Let us know.
The comments are going to be so screwed up on these posts because it's going to be talking about hot prisoners mm-hmm. and pooping
Kirk Cameron.
On tables. Kirk Cameron. I mean, I want the comments to be so unhinged in these
reels. I do too. So when Dorothy and Sophia go over to talk to Mary's dad, I love the runner with Sophia thinking that their dog ate Ida.
Wait. Can we talk about the editing of this episode? Because this part of the episode. Because there are so many tight shots. There's one shot of a close-up of Sophia's face, which is very odd and off-putting. There's another shot where it cuts quickly to the dog. Clearly, they had a lot of, like, the dog was probably not the best. It wasn't an anatomy of a fall dog. And there probably was, like, some quick shots they had to get of him and then some shots of Sophia. And, like, but they probably wanted a shot of the dog doing it with Sophia in the frame, but they couldn't get the dog to do it or something. Like, there were, but if you go back and watch this scene with Sophia in the scene, there are so many weird angles. There's even one angle where Dorothy turns around on the couch and it's like a close-up almost of Dorothy with Sophia in the background.
Yeah, I thought that dirty shot was a little weird. Yeah, I do love Estelle Getty's performance in this scene, though. Like, she's so timid. Like, excuse me, has he eaten? Like, it's so fun. I do want to play a little bit of Estelle Getty in this scene because she's so good.
Please.
Fred, I think I know how you feel about Mary.
No, you don't.
You feel because Mary went out and got herself pregnant, she's a slut. Well, let me tell you what a slut is. It's somebody who gets knocked up in the back seat of a Studebaker in a drive-in movie. It was a Studebaker, wasn't it, Dorothy?
It was a Nash, Ma.
Now that's a slut.
Estelle Getty definitely said the word slut the most, I think, on the Golden Girls. And then maybe Dorothy with, like, the slut is dead, long live the slut. But Sophia definitely said slut the most.
It's a fun word.
Slut.
Slut. You're a slut.
A slut. Yeah.
And proud of it.
Yeah. What is it? Oh, little Oreo has been not saying slut, but she's sort of starting to get that, like, hard L in words.
Has she cursed yet? Oh, my God. Has she cursed
yet? She did once.
Tell me what word.
So Stan was doing something under the sink, and she was, like, holding the flashlight. She's 2.5. This was, like, I don't know, a couple months ago, I think. Yeah. And I think he, like, banged his head or he noticed something was leaking or something, and I think he went like oh Jesus fuck, and then Oreo repeated it.
Yes,
and I was
girl.
Like I wasn't there for that, but he'll turn things into games, so you know, he'll be like, suck it, and then laugh, and then she'll go, suck it, and she'll laugh, and I don't know.
There is nothing funnier than a child saying fuck, or something, but fuck is really the best. I mean, fuck is like, I want a 2-year-old being like, fuck you, and that, and I want it as my ringtone.
I'm trying to think of the things that she says that are funny right now. I don't know, but she's definitely getting the hard L's, like in slut. She goes, closed. Like, mommy, I closed the door. And I'm like, you're so dramatic with that.
I love that.
It's great. So speaking of daughters and fathers and mothers and bad segues, I do love Dorothy's speech to Mary's dad. And I love that she tells the St. Olaf story. And we're not going to play it because we played it in the best St. Olaf stories compilation that we did a while back. But I also love how ashamed Dorothy is at the very end of the episode.
Oh, my God. Her walk is so funny. There's a great new movie out. I implore everyone to go watch it. It's called Problemista. And it's with Julio Torres and Tilda Swinton. It's Torres, right, Michael? Yeah. And Michael's sitting in the room with me. Dorothy's walk at the end of the episode is Julio's walk throughout the entire film. And it is a fucked up film. It is weird. It is silly. It is just wild. But he has this, like, bouncy walk that Dorothy kind of had at the end, and it made me think
it's
about.
Such a funny walk, the way she just walks with her head down. And I love the glee mm-hmm. on Rose's face when she realizes that Dorothy told a Saint Olaf story.
Well, but see, that there is in any friend group, when you find out something relatably embarrassing about somebody, it's just so sweet. You know what I mean? It's just so, like, for example, one of the things on You're Making It Worse that we bring up often with Elliot, so between Elliot and Brent, one of the things that Brent and I bring up about Elliot quite often is that Elliot is the sweetest, nicest man. He would never hurt anybody. He would never say anything bad about anybody. But you put that man behind a wheel and he becomes a monster. He is such a Long Island trashy, angry driver, and honk, screaming, yelling. And the thing is, he's not that good of a driver. He's not.
Why are we doing this?
But don't tell him that. Well, I've told him this. No, he's fine. He's a fine driver. But he's fine. He gets around. He did have an accident in my car once, but it's fine. He's a good driver, but he does have a road rage thing, and we constantly make. But that's what's so great about it is when you find out something so relatably embarrassing about a friend, and you're just like, I'm never gonna let you live it down. You're always gonna be that dude to me now, and it's kind of
yeah.
Fun.
It feels like that's what Rose is gonna do for Dorothy. Just like you love yes, Saint Olaf, yes. Come on, you love it.
You remember that literally years from now. You remember when she comes back, when she leaves the Hollingsworth Manor or whatever to come visit the now defunct hotel that they're just living in because they can't afford another place because, you know, property values are crazy. And she comes to visit. Rose is literally like, remember that time you told that Saint Olaf story? You loved it.
For sure. Yeah. And then Mary ends up making up with her dad and they leave together, and it's very, very sweet. And we never saw mm-hmm. or heard her from her again.
But we will hear from Mary again in our official chat with Julie McCullough. See, that was a great segue.
Paul Blart Mall Cop on a segue. Yes. That was a good segue.
That was me being a professional.
All right. We will be right back with a little snippet of our interview with Julie McCullough.
And then, of course, after our snippet with Julie, we will have our golden takeaways and everything. So don't go anywhere. So Julie, hi. So first question, I think the first question that I have for anyone who, because I mean, all of the great guest stars on The Golden Girls, I feel like, especially the younger guest stars, I wanted to know sort of what made you want to even be an actor before you even got into The Golden Girls?
Well, as a young person, I just wanted attention. I literally wanted attention so bad. I was in my high school band. I was in my high school choir. I was in drama. I was in speech therapy, speech communique. I was an artist. I thought I was going to be an artist. That's what I was aspiring to when I was young. And I just wanted attention. You know, when you're not getting attention from other students in a, you know, in your school, and you strive mm-hmm. for that. And so actors are almost all one or two things. There's no gray area. They're either complete introverts or they're complete extroverts. Mm-hmm. And I was definitely an extrovert. I was chatty and talkative, and, you know, I wanted to be seen. I wanted to be heard. That's just, you know, who you are as a person. Your makeup as a youth, in your youth, is kind of, you know, what you evolve to. And some people become killers and serial killers. And some people.
Well, I'm glad you went in another direction.
So that was it. Really for attention. I was a model. I wanted to be known as pretty. I was never considered a pretty girl in school. And I just wanted that attention. That's, I think, a lot of young people want
definitely.
That. They just want.
Definitely. Well, Mary Little Lamb, the episode, your episode of The Golden Girls, I mean, for a young actor, you were so early in your career at that point. I mean, and the entire episode revolves around your character, which is, for a young actor on a sitcom, that was what?
Fifth in its season
fourth or fifth
by
season?
Then.
I forget. Fifth season. It was a massive show. It had won Best Comedy Series Emmy. It was like a huge, huge show. I want to know, what was it like for you to get that kind of a gig?
I was so excited. I had been doing Growing Pains, and Growing Pains had got to be a real growing pain. And I had been a Playboy bunny early on in my career. And that was just not acceptable by one of my castmates on Growing Pains. And so the tabloid scrutiny began with that. And it was just, I was just getting all kinds of press, you know, some good, some
bad. And
we
all know who that castmate is, by the way.
And again, yeah, I don't even go into it, but when I got on the Golden Girls, those ladies were so accepting. They were so accepting. They were accepting of exactly who I am. And, you know, and I just, you know, the accolades, you know, that I getting from those women was tremendous. And when you're a young actor, to get that type of, you know, reaffirming feeling from women who were all your idols, who were funny, and just you respected them as entertainers. I respected them as human beings. So for me, it was just all encompassing. I'm like, exactly, and reaffirming as to why I was in this, you know, wild and wonderful world of Bane and
I will say, I mean, there was such a sweet vulnerability to the way that you played Mary that I really responded to and really loved, and I think can be kind of like a delicate balance for an actor to really play that kind of, you know, sweetness. And one thing that I also really loved about the episode is that, you know, over the course of the series, you know, the Golden Girls covered a lot of important topics, and this one was no different. You know, it covered teen pregnancy, and the women didn't judge Mary. They took her in, no questions asked. There was no shaming, no lecturing. At the time, did you sort of understand the magnitude of what that storyline kind of would be?
Absolutely understood the magnitude of it, because nobody was talking about that type of stuff hardly at all in film and TV, especially. It was a very conservative time, and you didn't get to see a lot of stuff. I mean, there was no cussing on TV, you know, everything was like so touch and go on network television. So yes, absolutely understood the magnitude of that. They didn't deal with, you know, alcoholism. They didn't deal with, you know, unwed mothers, teenage pregnancies. They didn't deal with gay people. They didn't deal with any type of thing that was considered taboo. AIDS. Nobody wanted to touch any subject. Suicide. It was so rare that television, the network shows were trying to evolve, but the Golden Girls were doing it and doing it beautifully. Really, way ahead of their time,
What was it like doing those sort of, I mean, just being on set, like you said, with some of your heroes, and you felt so supported as an actor, and it was just a very different experience to Growing Pains, which we'll talk about. I have some questions about Growing Pains in a little bit, but because I do think you need some justice for those days. But I want to know, like, what, especially someone like Bea Arthur, having those one-on-one scenes with Bea Arthur, who is just an icon of television, and who also, you know, probably had her own headlines over the years with everything she had with Maude and with the abortion episode and everything. I mean, people came for her too in a different way, but they came for her. So what was it like doing those sort of one-on-one scenes with Bea?
I really liked her. And the whole time I had a scene, you know, I was staying in her bedroom on the show, and, you know, she's giving me the talk, you know, late at night. And all I kept thinking, it's like, I was looking at her going, and then there's Maude. And there's Maude. Like, you know, like, I've had that with a few actors and entertainers over the years that, you know, I grew up watching, and in particular her, you know, that's scene. It's like, 'cause that's what you think when you're coming on and you're a fan. I was a fan. I grew up watching. I loved Maude. Maude was a fabulous show, and it still holds up as well. About an outspoken woman, you know, it's, and that's what she represented, and a woman who was outspoken, and you know, her and both her and Betty White, both were such leaders for women over all the years. Even looking back, like, they still stand as to what they stood, you know, up for. It's amazing the magnitude of what those women did for not just entertainment, but for human, you know, kind across the country, and animals, and it just, what they, the things that they stood up for in their public life was just as grand as what they were standing up for in their public, you know, in their TV, you know, fantasy worlds. They really kind of stayed true to actually who they were as people. And I think that's pretty outstanding, really. I mean, they were way ahead of their times. Those ladies were. And so it really, it paves the way for a lot of younger entertainers to come along and say, it's okay that I can go and stay up all night long and, you know, and help protest at an animal rescue, you know, event, which I did. I'm an animal activist. And so I had that in common with Betty. I went because my former co-star of my other show was so anti everything. I went and did the No Hate campaign, and you know, I was literally like in the first, some of the first sessions of that, painting No Hate on my face, because I was going to stand up for every gay person in the country, anybody that wanted to, you know, to get married for love. It's like, who are these ridiculous people, like, standing in their way? You know, so just, and it really just kind of paved the way. Those women were really, they just catapulted so much of society and the way I personally view things too. So, and I know I'm a comedian, even now I'm known as Money Bunny. It's like, I'm pretty outspoken and I don't bite my tongue too much. And, you know, I have those women to thank because they paved the road for so many of us.
Definitely. Oh, love Julie. Love Julie so, so much. And she is the reason for my golden takeaway this week, which a golden takeaway is a nugget of truth or inspiration that you can apply to your life or the lives of our listeners. Because I already gave mine away, I think you should go first because I don't want to, I'm going to make it great. I'm going to make it really good.
My golden takeaway is, be an advocate for your friends who were possibly eaten by a Doberman. Don't let that person's, absence, you know, go unnoticed. Try to get investigators in on it to really find out what happened. Take stool samples of the dog. Maybe if the dog if the dog is pregnant and giving birth, see if it poops and try to take some of that poop. But yeah, just don't just trust what people are saying. Like, really investigate and find out if the dog ate your friend.
Find out if the dog ate your friend. My golden takeaway this week is obviously, like I said, about Julie. And one of the things that I find fascinating, I've always found this very fascinating, is when somebody goes through a public shaming in a way. And the things that Julie went through during that time of the Kirk Cameron-ness of it all and all of the things and the way the girls really responded to her and opened up their arms to her and even let her be on this episode, that the show let her be on this episode while the scandal was going on, after I believe she had already been fired from Growing Pains. I think she had already been fired at this point. So the way she could have easily hidden away. She could have easily said, no, I'm no more jobs. I'm going to go away for a little bit, calm down, let things die down, and just sort of let the shame of the moment. And it's not, it wasn't there. She should have no shame at all for what she did. She was just a person living their lives. And it was someone else who put shame onto them. But that said, she instead persisted. She maintained what she was doing. She stayed true to her acting and her love of stand-up comedy and her love of being a good person and being a lover of animals and being, you know, she was just sort of very much like, this isn't going to change me or affect me. Sure, I'm sure it hit her emotionally, and I'm sure she had a lot of probably dark days, because it's a lot to take when, you know, now I'm thinking of like the internet and people who get canceled on the internet, and sometimes the scandals that happen on the internet, and like some of the bad things that can happen because of the internet, and how people handle those things. It can feel like the end of the world, and it can feel like it's the end of your career, or it's the end of who you are as a person, or you're not a valuable person, or you're not a good person. And Julie is a testament to being true to yourself, being true to your community, being true to being a good person, and that it isn't the end of your life when something like that happens. And it is actually just a bump in the road that makes it a part of your life, but it's not your entire life. And you can go on and do amazing things like Julie has done.
I think that's my golden takeaway. Really great golden takeaway.
Thank you. And now you should go over to the Patreon and listen to the full chat, because then after hearing that, you're going to be like, wow, Julie's amazing.
Yes, you can go to patreon.com/goldengirlspodcast for the rest of our chat with Julie. And this has been another episode of Out on the Lanai. Thank you all so, so much for listening. We will catch you back here next week for more Golden Girls greatness.
And we are a part of Mom Moguls of Media. So you can go subscribe to Mom Plus and support all the other fantastic podcasts at Mom. And you can also follow us on social media at Golden Girls Pod on Twitter, Out on the Lanai Official on Instagram, Golden Girls Pod on the face pages. And I am H. Allen Scott /Sadie Pines on everything.
And I'm Squid Eat Squid on Twitter and Squidzy on Instagram. And also, if you want to take a moment and rate and review us wherever you get this podcast, that would be amazing. We would appreciate it.
Yes. And remember,
what is that? What are you doing right now?
This is just me. I don't know what you're talking. If you're watching on the Patreon, you're going to see something special. No, I'm just being me, Carrie. I don't know why you think this is weird.
Assaulted right now. What is
why? Why? Stop. It's my hands are up. Stop. No, guys, people listening on podcasts are like, what the fuck is going on? Michael, every single morning puts this doll on my chair, and the doll doesn't have a head on it because Michael does, like, he recreates the dolls and like puts new hair on them and stuff. And so every morning he puts on the chair and he's like, I didn't put it on the chair. And he's committed to this bit that this scary doll just sits on my chair and magically gets there herself.
She's also
and
naked.
So now, yeah, of course she is. And so... And so I decided to only put her in the frame of the video, and we're going to end the podcast with her saying, and remember,
as always,
let me put her hands up because it's excitable.
Stay golden. This is disturbing. Is that Ida? Is that what's left of Ida?
I love you, Carrie.
Get her tits out of my face.
Out on the Lanai is not endorsed by Whit Thomas Harris Productions, Touchstone Television, Disney, or any of its subsidiaries. It is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
All names, pictures, audio, and video clips of the Golden Girls are registered trademarks and/or copyrights of their respective trademark and/or copyright holders.